Thank you everyone for coming. We've been trying to go through chronologically the different accomplishments of Srila Prabhupada from 1969. So the last few days we've been covering up until 1974. And I think last night we mentioned that Srila Prabhupada was very concerned about the opening of the Krishna Balaram temple. It went off to a false start in 1974, on Janmashtami 1974. It was announced the temple was going to be open at that, you know, particular time, Janmashtami 1974. But in fact, the construction work was still going on. So then it was rescheduled to open on Ram Nomi of 1975. And so Prabhupada was especially concerned because there was a very important guest had been invited. His name was Dr. Channa Reddy, and he was the governor for Uttar Pradesh. That's the state where Mathura and Vrindavan are located in present-day India. And so actually Prabhupada got to Vrindavan a little earlier, and there were still some last-minute things going on. But pretty much the whole inside of the temple had been completed, and there was a parikrama path made of red stone that was still not quite complete. So when Prabhupada got there, and a lot of other devotees also were anticipating the temple opening in Ram Nomi, and so they were praising Sarabi, the architect, the Dutch architect, for his work. But when Prabhupada got there, he could only see faults. And so in the morning walks, he, you know, going around the construction site, he was chastising Sarab like anything. And he even commented, he said, actually, as your spiritual master, it's my responsibility to chastise the student. Others may be praising you, but my responsibility is to chastise you. And one of the things that he really didn't like was the thin stone slabs that had been cut for this parikrama mark, you know, the paths round the temple. They were too thin. And he had expressly said that the stone should be very thick, like this thick. So just like at the Radha Govinda temple, the original Radha Govinda temple, if you study the stonework there, it's very, very thick. And therefore it's lasted hundreds of years, because that temple, the construction work began in the 1500s, and it was financed by Maharaj Man Singh. And so Prabhupada was always seeing the faults, but that was certainly his position. And also, of course, we learned so much in that time. And, of course, the story is there how Srila Prabhupada brilliantly, rather than involving us in installing the deities, you know, for the Pranpratishtha ceremony, he invited all the local brahmanas from all the principal temples in Vrindavan. So there was priests from the Bhakti Bihari temple, from the Radha Balabh temple, from the Radha Gopinath temple, from the Radha Raman temple, from the Radha Damodar temple, and so on. And so his idea was that they cannot criticize, because he was presuming, because we're all coming from Western countries and we're not coming from, you know, Brahmin family backgrounds, that they would try to turn off any visitors to our temple by saying, well, you know, that's not a bona fide temple, they're not qualified. But rather, by engaging all the local priests, how can they criticize each other? They're not going to do that. And actually, they all agreed. They thought this was a great honor for them. And so they did this very, very elaborate ceremony where all the deities were taken out of a big room just behind Prabhupada's darshan room. And they were placed next to this little temporary hut that was built at the back of the courtyard. And in this little hut, they had all these different pots, and all these pots represented so many demigods. And the deities were covered from head to toe in white cloth. And every day, they would remove a piece of cloth, starting from the feet, and then working their way up. And so every day, the deities were progressing towards the altar. So that finally, they were placed on the... Of course, they were all chanting mantras, Purushottam mantras, and so many other mantras, but not Hare Krishna. Every mantra you can imagine except the Maha Mantra. And then the last strip was the strip that was binding their eyes. And in the final day, that piece of cloth was removed. Pran means life-giving, so that life-giving ceremony was completely done by them. Then afterwards, Prabhupada made sure that all of the priests who engaged in that ceremony were given envelopes with various denominations of rupees in the envelopes, from 5,001 rupees down to 101 rupees, depending on their status. So I was given that responsibility to make sure that they all got their envelopes. Before the deities were installed, because I had been in Delhi, then I'd been in Moradabad, then I'd gone to Mayapur, Prabhupada called me in and he asked me, he said, have you seen the deities? This is before, when they were just lying in the back room. And I said, no, Srila Prabhupada, I haven't had the opportunity of seeing the deities, because they had just arrived from Jaipur. And so I said, you should go there and look. And there were all the deities, Prabhupada, the Prabhupada Murti, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Thakur Murti, Gorni Thai Murtis, Krishna Balaram, and Radhashyam Sundar, Lalita Vishaka, they were all there. And Jamuna had ordered the deities and supervised their making, so they weren't standing there with marble cloth, just like in the 70s, Radhalangeshwara, they had already sari and dhoti and shawl and crowns, all carved, you know, as they were making the deity, the Murtiwalas would traditionally produce the deities with marble clothing. Not that you kind of had like a box of clothing and you put the marble clothing on the deity, but they were just carved like that with earrings and all kinds of things, you know, sticking out, which makes it difficult for pujaris to dress the deities. And so Jamuna came up with this idea of just making smooth deities, just with their kopins, with their, you know, absolute minimum cloth, marble cloth, so for the pujaris it would be very, very easy to put on different types of clothing. And Srila Prabhupada approved of that idea. As far as I know, the Krishna Balam temple was the first temple to have such types of deities carved, specifically without clothing. So then I paid my obeisances, came out of the room, and I said, Prabhupada, the deities look absolutely gorgeous, and the pujaris will be very, very happy with the way they've been made. And then for some reason I said, we all know that this temple is going to be called the Krishna Balaram temple. But we don't really know the names of the Radha Krishna deities. Have you considered giving a name to those deities? And Prabhupada very mercifully, he said to me, he said, well, can you think of a name? And on that spontaneous moment, I said, Radha Shamsundar? He said, yes, we'll call them Radha Shamsundar. And later on, when the deities were installed, of course, and then we started all the arti ceremonies and all the offerings and everything, because, you know, the temple, practically speaking, went from, you know, from a building site, a construction site, to a full-on temple after that Prampratishtha ceremony. Because up to then, there was, you know, there was nothing really happening in that building. And then we also had to house 65 devotees. It was just like a full package. All of a sudden, we had 10 big deities and 65 devotees to look after. And so, although it appeared superficially that I was the internal temple president, really Prabhupada was in charge. And I was just running around doing things for him, because he was instructing me to do the nikko. And he was very particular about every single detail, because this really was his pet project. This is something that his whole life had worked for, you can say, to establish a beautiful temple in Vrindavan, where he also had his own house built, custom built for him, and a place where all his Western disciples could feel at home. So when it came to the different offerings, and the way, of course, the temple was constructed, there were two rooms. When you go into the main entrance of the Krishna Balaram temple, there's two rooms either side, on the right and the left. And so Prabhupada wanted the room on the left used for selling Mahaprasadam. And that was a concept also that we had never heard of before, because we always presumed that Mahaprasadam was never sold, it was just distributed to all the devotees. But Prabhupada said, well, just like in Banki Bihari temple, they have the tradition there that they make huge amounts of prasadam, different types of prasadam, kachoris and laddu, and they sell this, and this is how they maintain the deity worship. He said, so we will also introduce the same system here. And that was the very first ISKCON temple where Prabhupada gave that instruction to sell Mahaprasadam. He also went into great detail what should be cooked for the deities. And he wanted 21 preparations made for the Rajbhog offering. And he wanted every deity on the altar to have their own personal plate. And he told me that the purest plate to offer to the deity is not gold, not silver, but lotus leaf. But of course, they weren't available in the marketplace because there weren't many lotus flowers growing anywhere nearby our temple. And Jamuna had made marble, or not made, but she had ordered marble plates and marble bowls. And so we used those for some time, but unfortunately they were very fragile. And they ended up just being broken due to carelessness when they were being cleaned. So Prabhupada said, after lotus leaves there's gold, after gold there is silver. And then he said, after silver there is bell metal. So I did some, obviously I had to calculate how much the plates were going to cost and how much we could afford to spend on the plates. So we settled on bell metal, and then we had every name of every deity inscribed. Of course, also another unique thing was that Prabhupada allowed his own murti to be installed on the altar in his presence. Because there was no other temple in ISKCON with a Prabhupada murti on the altar. That was also a first. And he said that, so that's a lot of cooking, you imagine. I mean, these are big plates with lots of bowls and cups. Ten plates for every single offering. For Mangal Arti, for the breakfast time, for the Rajbhog, the noon offering, for the fruit offering at 4 o'clock, and then later on, the milk offering. So we had some very good cooks to begin with that came. I don't know if you know a devotee called Narottam Ananda. He came from France. So he was there. Apurva was also there. Two really good cooks. But eventually, one of Prabhupada's godbrothers came, his name was Anand, and he was cooking. Because Vrindavan is a very extreme place for climate. It's extremely hot in the summer. I've experienced 60 degrees Celsius in Vrindavan. The average temperature in May, June, if there's no rain coming immediately, can go well beyond 50 Celsius, between 50 and 55. You can say probably these are unheard of temperatures in Europe. I know that in Amsterdam in the summer it went up to about 30 Celsius, and everybody was complaining how hot it was. Unbearably hot at 30 degrees Celsius. But Vrindavan is quite different. And in the winter, it can get very cold. It can go down to zero. So that's the range from 0 to 50 and above. So Western devotees kind of didn't really last very long under those circumstances, because we didn't really have many facilities like air conditioning or even water coolers. What to speak of electricity, we had very little of that, and we didn't have any generators. And it's interesting because the whole construction of the temple and the guest house and Prabhupada's house was done by this Muslim contractor called Alabax, and all the wiring was done by two Muslim brothers, Nazim Mistry and Anwar. And they didn't make a diagram. You know, you're supposed to have like a diagram of where all the wiring is. And even to this present day, Anwar has us all over a barrel when it comes to fixing the wiring. Only he knows where the wiring is, even after all these years, since 1975. And the guest house, Prabhupada also wanted the guest house run very efficiently. It was built with 65 rooms on a very tiny piece of land. It was ingeniously worked out by Saurabh how to get that number of rooms out of the minimum amount of space. And so Prabhupada, he pretty much made all the decisions, like how much was a room going to cost to rent. So he actually told me that we should follow the same standard as another guest house in Vrindavan called the Jaipuria guest house, which is a Marwari-run guest house near Bankya Bihari Temple. So in those days, a single room was rented at the rate of 8 rupees per day, and a double room was 12 rupees per day. And he also wanted us to serve lunch and dinner. We had this upstairs dining hall. And he also said that whatever they're making in their guest house, we should also make in our guest house and charge the exact same rate. So what they did was they had a very nice tully. A tully means a set meal with a wet sabji, a dry sabji, with a coriander chutney, with yogurt, with a popper, with freshly made chapatis that had to be brought out as people ordered them. They weren't just sitting on the plate. They had to come out fresh from the kitchen. And also raita. That was also very important, plus a sweet. So that was, and actually Prabhupada also said, he said that there should be kacha cooking in the day and paka cooking in the evening. Kacha and paka. Kacha means chapatis, and paka means fried things like puris and pakoras and samosas. So he said, you know, it's easy to digest kacha at noon because the sun is very strong, it's high in the sky, but at night it's easier to digest fried things. That's why he made that comparison between kacha and paka. And so a standard tully with unlimited chapatis, in other words, you didn't charge extra for every chapati someone ate over and above two or three or whatever, was 5 rupees a tully. And then he also said that we should sell the rooms to our life members. If somebody wanted to buy a room, then a single room would cost 1 lakh of rupees, and a double room would cost 2 lakhs. 1 lakh means 100,000 rupees. And I have to say that it wasn't that difficult, first of all, to make life members or to encourage people to buy rooms. They were filing into the office. My office was where Prabhupada's library is at the present moment. If you've been to Vrindavan, you know where the library, that's with, you know, the bookcase and all the books from, you know, translated in all the different languages. So that was my office. And basically I sat in the office and people would come and visit me with pockets full of money, wanting to become life members and wanting to buy rooms. And when Prabhupada went on a tour and he came to see where the president's office was, he immediately thought, well, this room is too big. We can use this for something else. And then he decided to turn that office into a bank. Not a devotee bank, but, you know, we had what's known as the PNB, the Punjab National Bank. They were offered the room at a certain rent. And so Prabhupada was always thinking like that. He was always thinking how to manage everything financially as well as spiritually. Both things had to be there. So Prabhupada also supervised pretty much all the purchasing of all the bhoga. He would scrutinize all the bills firsthand, and he would also interview those devotees who were in charge of the shopping, of where they were shopping and how much they were paying for potatoes, or how much they were paying for okra, bindi, that's the Hindi name for okra is bindi, or aubergine, eggplants, or rice, or ghee, or any milk. So many different things Prabhupada wanted, you know, he scrutinized everything microscopically. And he actually, just by looking at the bills, he could see that someone was stealing ghee from the Didi kitchen. He could work it out. There's a certain ratio of ghi to atta. Atta meaning flour. Because you use ghi for frying things, usually, like puris and pakoras and samosas and other things. So he actually understood that someone was stealing ghee from the kitchen. And that was at the time when Anand was cooking. So he told me, he said, you have to tell him to leave. He's stealing the ghee and taking it down to his temple, because his Gaudiamat temple, his Gaudiya Vaishnav temple, was Imlitala Mandir. Imli means tamarind. So there was at one time, at least then, there was a big tamarind tree growing near the Jamuna. And that was the place where Lord Chaitanya rested during his time spent in Vrindavan. And so, actually it was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He proposed that a temple should be built at that spot. So that was Imlitala Mandir. And that's where Anand Prabhu was from Orissa. He was a brahmachari, and he was about the same age as Srila Prabhupada, but he was very active. I mean, he wasn't at all reduced in his strength, because he'd been a lifelong brahmachari. So he could handle the heat, he could handle a lot of heavy work, and he never complained. But he had this tendency to look after his own devotees, you know, down in the Imlitala Mandir. So he was actually doing that. He was taking ghee and distributing the ghee to his devotees in Imlitala Mandir. So Prabhupada told me that I should tell them that I know what you're doing, and so now you should leave. And I felt very uncomfortable doing that. I said, Srila Prabhupada, he's your godbrother. I don't know if I'm really senior enough, you know, to tell him to leave. And Prabhupada understood. He said, okay, I'll have a talk with him. And Prabhupada was really expert in the way he dealt with his godbrothers. We were coming back from a morning walk, and Anand Prabhu happened to be there, and Prabhupada called him over, and he started speaking to him in Bengali. And he was joking with him. He was more or less telling him, well, yeah, we figured out that you're stealing the ghee. And I'm afraid you can't stay here if that's what you continue to do, if you're going to continue. And so Anand Prabhu, he was, you know, he didn't take it wrong. He took it, you know, on the chin. And so he packed up his little bag that same day and left. Of course, that put a great strain on the Didi kitchen. But somehow or another, we managed. And Prabhupada was really concerned that all the devotees were looked after properly, that we're getting sufficient cow's milk and also sufficient cow's ghee. And there was a major shortage of those things in Vrindavan at that time. I mean, all you could find in the market was buffalo ghee and very little cow's milk. So a lot of buffalo milk was used too. But Prabhupada didn't like that. He said, if you drink the milk of a buffalo, you get the brain of a buffalo. It's not beneficial like cow's milk. There's a gulf of difference between cow's milk and buffalo milk. So then, some Australian devotees, they volunteered that they could bring cans of ghee from Australia. And for a while, Vrindavan was like the storage depot for cans of ghee. And they were distributed from Vrindavan to the other temples, the other centers. And Srila Prabhupada also said about the guests that came to stay in our guest house. He said, if they're not so interested in practicing bhakti yoga, because of course you know, all different kinds of people would come to Vrindavan. They'd come to get away from their city. They'd come just to be in the countryside, because in those days, Vrindavan was a very sleepy town in 1975. It wasn't a bustling place. There were only two cars in the whole of Vrindavan, two beat-up ambassador cars. They were owned by two Goswamis from the Bankya Bihari temple. So there was lots of bicycles, there was a few motorbikes, but there was a lot of bullock carts, camel carts, no tractors. There were no tractors in those days. So, and there was some beat up old buses too. I remember the buses were in a terrible state. And of course the train would leave from Mathura for Delhi quite regularly. And tongas, you know what a tonga is? It's a horse-drawn buggy. And so you could take a tonga from Mathura Junction to the Angrejika Mandir. That was what the locals called their temple. They didn't call it the Krishna Balaram Mandir, they called it the Angrejika Mandir. Angreja means English. The English temple, or the foreign temple. And that would cost 2 rupees, one way, from Mathura to. And rickshaws, so many rickshaws. The rickshaw would cost 1 rupee 50 paisa return, up and down, 75 paisa one way. No, from Krishna Balaram temple to Lai Bazaar. A rickshaw you can get for about 2 rupees 50 paisa from Mathura Junction to Angrejika Mandir. And it's really interesting because when Prabhupada got that land, because in those days too we had what was known as a chungi. A chungi is the place where you're entering the town, and there's a barrier at that chungi, and you have to pay some tax. If you've bought something outside of Vrindavan and you're bringing it into Vrindavan, say like some plastic water containers or maybe some trunks or something like that you've purchased outside, you have to pay. It's called octroi. I don't know where that term comes from anyway, but that's what they called at that time, octroi, at the chungi, or the tax collection area. And our temple was very, very close to that spot. So it was really completely at the outer limits of Vrindavan. And there was no light on that road going to our temple. So it was considered to be a very, very dangerous place to visit, because the place is full of dacoits and gundas. Dacoits mean thieves, and gundas mean, well, they're armed thieves. They usually have weapons. And, you know, they're willing to use them too if you put up any resistance. So all the local people would say to Prabhupada, "Oh, Swamiji, you're wasting so much of your foreign money in building a temple up. No one will come there. It'll be a big disaster. You will not be successful." But actually, if you go to Vrindavan now, that's really the place to be. I mean, there's so much construction of new buildings going on all the time. Unfortunately, I suppose, in one way. But it's certainly a huge success, because still the number one temple is Bankya Bihari, and then the number two temple is the Krishna Balaram Mandir. So when people visit, you know, to have darshan of the deities, they go to first of all Bankya Bihari, and then they come to the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And so Srila Prabhupada, every morning at 6 o'clock, we go for a morning walk up usually up the Chatikara road, which became known as the Bhaktivedanta Swami Marg. And he would turn around at the same spot every day. So he'd go out for a walk for 1 hour. And one morning, there was maybe about 30 of us with Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada insisted that I had to go with him every single morning, whether I wanted to or not. And some of you who may be managers or will become future managers, it's not so easy to manage a big temple with 65 devotees and 10 deities, because there's always something happening, and be exactly at Prabhupada's front door at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I really had to struggle to get there, and sometimes I'd be a few minutes late, and Prabhupada wouldn't leave until I showed up. And then, of course, he would chastise me for being late, because Prabhupada didn't like to be kept waiting. And but at the same time, you know, it was a real lesson in keeping time, keeping punctuality. Even in London, too, I remember, when I was going out doing some fundraising for Berry Place, I was supposed to be back in the temple to take lunch with Srila Prabhupada. And I came 10 minutes late. And Prabhupada waited, and he asked me, he said, "Why have you taken 10 minutes more time?" I said, "Well, Srila Prabhupada, I had a £2,000 appointment. Someone was going to give a donation." And Prabhupada smiled, then he said, "Well, from now on, you can only be late for a £10,000 appointment." So that was really something that Prabhupada expected of his managers, that they were always there at his side, always there to take instruction from him. And so this one particular morning, Srila Prabhupada was in the middle, we were around him, and there was this, he appeared to be a local sadhu with Vaishnav Tilak on. And he was on the same side of the road as us, and he was walking directly towards Srila Prabhupada. And generally speaking, when any other Vaishnavas would be coming back from their walk, as we were walking, starting our walk, then, you know, the etiquette is that you give way to the bigger group. But this man was completely determined to walk straight into Srila Prabhupada. And of course, we had to jump in front of Prabhupada and push him away. And the only comment that Prabhupada made about that incident was, "He is Kali Chela. He's a servant of Kali." Although he appears externally with Vaishnava markings and Kunti Mala. Because that's the unfortunate symptom of Kali Yuga, that there's so many rascals and so many cheaters. There was a Mr. Seth Disenchant who also regularly met with Srila Prabhupada. He would sit on this wall just a few hundred meters away from the temple and wait for Srila Prabhupada to pass by. And Prabhupada always stopped and talked with him. He was a retired MP, member of parliament, from Lucknow. And he had retired in Ramanreti. And he was actually a very, very nice man. But he had the habit of worshipping Lord Shiva. So Prabhupada always had heated debates with him that in Vrindavan, this is not the place to worship Lord Shiva, this is the land of Krishna. And he said, "Oh, it is my habit, Swamiji, I've been doing it since I was a young boy. I can't help myself. I'm completely dedicated to Lord Shiva, because after all, I became a very successful politician just by worshipping him every day. So he kept that habit up in Vrindavan. So just see that even your, you know, Indian born, you're born into a certain culture, you end up living in Vrindavan, but you can also completely miss the point. But Prabhupada also was fond of him because, you know, he was very friendly and he really liked the foreign devotees. In fact, Prabhupada was invited to Seth Bisenchan's house for lunch. And he said, well, I will come, but you have to offer everything to Krishna first. Then you can offer it to Lord Shiva afterwards. So he got a picture of Krishna. He made that adjustment for Prabhupada. And in fact, we were all invited. So we went to his house and we all took prasadam. And there was another very favorable Vaishnav who belonged to the, it's called the Char Sampradaya. Char meaning four. This is four bona fide Vaishnav Sampradayas. You know the names of the four Vaishnav Sampradayas? Rudra Sampradaya, also known as the Nimbarka Sampradaya. Yeah, and there's the four Kumaras. Yeah. So his name was Vishwambar Dayal Agarwal, but his nickname was Bhagaji. And he was also retired, and he was living very close at his house. It's still there. He passed away in the 1980s. But he was also very, very fond of Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was really fond of his cooking, especially his chapatis and his parathas, because he cooked in a very simple kitchen in his house. And he used cow dung. These, you know, these cow patties you see on the walls that dry in the sun, and then they take them off. Prabhupada really liked his chapatis like anything, and also his subjects too. And in fact, he invited him to become GBC for Vrindavan, because he was living permanently there, and he was very intelligent. He was a very successful businessman before he retired. And in fact, he did travel occasionally to different parts of India to meet Srila Prabhupada. He went to Hyderabad one time, he also went to Mumbai. And they showed extreme affection towards each other. Also, there was a godbrother, his name was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji. And he lived near Barsana. And he had been given Babaji by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And he was also a very successful businessman before he became fully engaged in chanting the Maha Mantra. And they would also have very, very lively conversations. But with us, all he would say, whenever we asked him a question, even when it was translated, he'd always reply, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. That was his, you know, that was the way he responded to any question that we would ask him. He would only chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And also it was during that time that an American boy came to meet Srila Prabhupada. And he apparently had been diagnosed as having some terminal illness. And so Prabhupada decided that he should be given... Babaji is even higher than sannyas in the sense that it's the most renounced position. They don't wear a sannyas full dhoti, but they wear just a tiny little bit of cloth, white cloth. And they don't particularly preach, they just chant on their japa beads that live in seclusion. So Prabhupada named this American disciple Adolomi Das Babaji. And he told him that after he gave him this title, that he should spend the rest of his days in Mayapur, that he should construct a very simple cottage away from the devotees in some isolated field, and that he should take prasadam with, you know, from the devotees and take that prasadam back to his little hut and eat by himself and chant minimum for 16 hours a day. So, you know, we were all impressed that, you know, this young boy, basically he was in his 20s, was awarded such a role in our society. That was never given to anybody else. There was the one and only disciple that got this title. But when he got to Mayapur, somehow or another, he started to recover from this terminal illness. And he went to the local town, Krishnanagar, and he was given an inspection by some medical officer there. And he was then referred to Kolkata, and he went to some real expert physician, and the expert physician concluded that he had overcome his terminal illness, and he was going to live for many, many years. So when he heard this news, unfortunately he didn't go back to Mayapur, he went back to the West. It's one of those tragic stories where, you know, someone comes before Prabhupada and it appears to be very genuine, but as soon as he understood he had fully recovered, then he, instead of staying in ISKCON and being really considering himself to be most fortunate, he unfortunately did the opposite thing and left. So, time is a great revealer of one's nature, one's character. A few weeks later, during aartis, we would ring the aarti bell during the aarti, which doesn't really happen in many Western temples, but in India it's quite common to ring a bell during the whole aarti ceremony. It's considered very auspicious. So this aarti bell, which was hung up just at the, there's the courtyard, and then you go up the steps, and there's the, what's known as the Darshan Mandap, and Prabhupada's Vyasasan is on one side. So, as you're approaching that Darshan Mandap, there used to be a bell, but that bell was rung so loudly one time by one very over-enthusiastic devotee, and the bell fell, because the bit of metal, it was like a hook. That hook broke. And fortunately the bell didn't hit the person who's ringing the bell, but it crashed into the marble with so much force that it actually dented the marble. And the bell broke. So that bell was finished. And I decided that I wanted to buy a much bigger bell, and I wanted to install that bell above the main entrance to the temple. Because if you look at the architecture, it just looks like a natural bell tower there. That was my plan. So I paid 3,000 rupees for this bell. It was about quite a lot of weight, maybe 40, 50 kilos. And I wanted Srila Prabhupada to hear the bell before I stuck it up in the bell tower above the front entrance. So I got two workers to push a bamboo pole through the round hole at the top of the bell and bring it into Prabhupada's room. Of course, I told Prabhupada what I was going to do, and he said, "Yeah, let me hear the bell." So the bell was brought into his room, and I rang the bell at a very, very nice sound. And then Prabhupada said, "This is a very nice bell. Hang it in the tree in the courtyard. In the courtyard, there's a tamal tree. The one that's there now isn't the original one, because the original one drowned, left its body, then we planted another one. But there was a tree there, and it wasn't very big, and to me, it didn't seem to be very strong." So I was quite surprised that Prabhupada wanted this bell hung in the tree. So I tried to reason with Srila Prabhupada. I said, "Prabhupada, I don't know if that's a good idea, because the bell is very heavy, and if you hang it in one of the branches of the tree, because it's so heavy, the branch will surely break when you start, ringing the rope, pulling on the rope to ring the bell." And so Prabhupada said, "What is your idea?" I said, "Well, I'd like to hang it above the main entrance. There's a very nice place there, and it seems ideal." And Prabhupada said, "No, I want it hung in the tree." And so again, I argued with Srila Prabhupada. I just said, "Well, no, I don't think that's really the place for the bell to be hung." Then Prabhupada said for the third time, "Hang it in the tree." And I said, "Prabhupada, I'm not going to hang it in the tree." So at that moment, Prabhupada said, "You can do any damn thing you want, but I want it hung in the tree." And still, I disobeyed him. I didn't hang it in the tree. I hung it in the bell tower, what I thought was a bell tower. And so then, then Prabhupada called me. He said, "I've been thinking about that bell." He said, "That bell shouldn't just be rung during arti time. It should be rung on the hour, every hour, and also on the half hour." And he said, "And the reason I'm telling you this is because there's so many poor people in Vrindavan, and they don't possess watches. They don't have their own watch. They can't tell the time. So besides the bell being rung during the arti ceremonies, we can also ring it on the hour, every hour. So they will also hear the sound, and they will know now it's 1 o'clock, now it's 2 o'clock, now it's 3 o'clock. And he said, "It has to be rung 24 hours. And then also he said, "If it isn't rung, then we will know that the night guards are sleeping. And if the night guards don't ring the bell," and he points to me and he says, "then you have to ring the bell." So I understood what Prabhupada was saying. I said, "Okay, sure, Prabhupada, I'll inform." In Hindi, they're called chokidars, the watchmen, the guards. So I instructed him this is what Prabhupada wanted to happen. And so for the next few days, the bell was being rung. Prabhupada heard the bell also because, when we're coming back on the morning walk, that's the first thing you hear. Because Prabhupada would always arrive exactly at 7 o'clock, because in those days, deity greeting was at 7 o'clock in the morning. And but then a couple of nights later, I was taking rest in the inner courtyard of the guest house, and I was sharing a room with Upendra, who was Prabhupada's servant, and Brahmananda happened to be Prabhupada's secretary. So at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I hear this really loud banging on the door, our door. And so I kind of woke up, because it was kind of very, very loud. It wasn't a very gentle type of knocking. It was a boom, 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 like this, and I was wondering what on earth is going on. So I open the door, and of course, Brahmananda takes up the whole doorway. And he says, Prabhupada wants to see you right away. And I said, do I have time to put on my dhoti? He said, no, come in your gumcha. Come right now. And I said, well, do you know what it's about? He'll tell you. So, like that, you know, he's quite strong in his way of getting the message across. And so then I followed Brahmananda, you know, down the stairs and then up the stairs to where Prabhupada was in his bedroom. In his house, there's an upstairs bedroom with a nice veranda, and also there's a shower and toilet up there too, and that's where Prabhupada would do his translating work. And so then I follow Brahmananda into Prabhupada's room. Prabhupada's sitting by his table, and there's a lamp on, and Prabhupada's got his glasses on, and he's doing some translating work, and I pay my obeisances. And Prabhupada looks at me and he said, you did not hear? That's all he said. And I really didn't know what that meant at that particular moment in time. I did not, what was I not hearing? Obviously I was taking rest at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then some kind of really strange kind of idea came into my head that something terrible had happened. You know, maybe someone had been in an accident. Who knows? I mean, there's so many things can happen in India. And so I had to reply, no, Prabhupada, I didn't hear. And he said, go and ring the bell. The bell was not rung at 2 o'clock. And wake up the chokidar. So this is Prabhupada's way of getting back at me for arguing with them. And anyway, so the chokidar was fast asleep, as Prabhupada had predicted, that, you know, if the bell didn't ring, then there was a way of telling what was happening there at the front of the temple. And anyway, so then I really chastised the chokidar. I told him he'd lose his job if this happened again. And then I reassured Prabhupada that the chokidar understood his position and he had to ring that bell throughout the entire night, on the hour and on the half hour. So a few more days passed by and we were coming back from this morning walk. And as I said, Prabhupada always perfectly timed his return to the temple. So there the chokidar is standing with the rope, ringing the bell. So it's 7 o'clock, so it's boom, 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 then nothing. No sound. Because what had happened was, the rope had broken. And so there was the chokidar standing with all this rope at his feet. And the bell couldn't be rung anymore because the rope had snapped. And then Prabhupada turns to me and it's about 10 or 15 sannyasis and GBCs and BBT trustees and all big senior devotees. And they looked at me in disgust and he said, no brain, simply buffalo stool. That's what he said. No brain, simply buffalo stool. That means between the ears, you know. And so I didn't feel very comfortable. Understandably, after he said those words. And then I tried to use some excuse. Well, this was made with jute rope. The jute rope is not very strong. In fact, there was an edge, because, you know, where the bell is, it has, you know, the rope had to, you know, go around this very sharp edge. And as it was being rung, it was obviously, you know, being cut by that sharp edge, you know, day after day after day, until finally, it was just absolutely perfect timing for Srila Prabhupada. I mean, Prabhupada is always, you know, expert at timing. Timing is everything. So, I said, well, now I'm going to get some nylon rope. And he said, whatever you try to do will be useless. But actually, eventually we come up with the idea of putting the little pulley with the little wheel. And that's the system that's used even today. It's not a good idea to argue with the spiritual master, because the spiritual master always wins in the end. Although it's interesting, because Prabhupada never again talked about moving the bell to the tree. But, you know, it just remained where it was, and that's where it is today. So, because, you know, Prabhupada wanted us to utilize our intelligence to overcome problems. Another morning, we had just finished the room on the right-hand side. We painted it and decorated it, and that was the book room. We had all the Prabhupada's books on display. And we'd also put colored lights around the actual bookcase to make it attractive. We'd put a big mattress on the floor with a big white sheet with bolsters, and there was also a table and chair there. And so my idea was to show Srila Prabhupada what we'd done to that room, where we could also sit with guests, where we could talk to them about becoming life members and giving regular donations and so on. So Prabhupada, I asked him, I said, before you go into deity greeting, if you can come a little earlier, you know, perhaps, you know, shorten your walk, so you have about 10 minutes time. So if we could come back by 10 to 7 rather than 7 o'clock, then we can show you this this book room that we've just decorated. So he agreed with that, and we brought a chair for Prabhupada to sit on if he wanted to use that chair. So we're all there, and the local GBC man is also there, because he really liked the idea of having a special room just for selling Prabhupada's books, because he was a BBD trustee also. And so Prabhupada enters the room, and he sits down in the chair, and he hasn't said anything. I said, Prabhupada, do you like this room, how we've decorated it? And the first thing he says is illicit sex. And that was something that we didn't expect Prabhupada would say in a book room. And I looked at my GBC, and he looked at me, and we were wondering, what has Prabhupada found out? Is there something going on in the guest house that we don't know about, that Prabhupada found out before us or something? And then what Prabhupada did was, he raised his walking stick. He said, you're looking like this and thinking everything is first class. But, and then he started moving his walking stick in that direction, in upwards direction. And we followed the tip of his walking stick. And we, you know, the ceiling's quite high. It's about maybe another 2 meters higher than this ceiling. It's really high. And then we looked right up to where he was pointing his walking stick, to the fan. There was a fan there. And then we saw that two pigeons had made a nest. And he was talking about the pigeons having illicit sex and on the fan. So he said this. He said, you're thinking that everything, because you're seeing everything like this. But he said, I'm seeing everything like this. You know, he went around like that with his eyes. We had never noticed. Nobody had actually even said anything. Because in those days, we hadn't put any wire netting up. Even the courtyard didn't have wire netting. And we had so many birds would come in, especially during the time of Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam class. We'd have parrots flying in and so many pigeons. And they would make such a racket, such a noise. It was very disturbing. And we had to, you know, get huge long bamboo poles and chase all the birds away. Finally, somebody came up with the brilliant idea of just putting wire netting right across that big empty space in where the courtyard is to stop them from actually coming in, and then also put netting where the holes are, because there's so many holes everywhere for the birds to, you know, to come through. He was also very concerned that no devotees should visit other ashrams. He said that there are so many people with so much information about Radha Krishna. So if they say something that I have not said, then you may become confused and think, well, why hasn't my spiritual master told me this and this and this? So he said the best thing is that when the devotees come, they should just stay in the temple and not go out and listen to others speaking. He was very, very adamant about that. He constantly emphasized this particular point. Even visiting his own godbrothers, he didn't particularly like us to do that, to go to other Gaudiya Math temples. But he did invite his godbrothers. One time, Madhav Maharaj from the Sri Chaitanya Math came to visit Srila Prabhupada. And Madhav Maharaj was born in a Brahmin family. And Prabhupada was born in the Suvarna Malik family, or the Kayastha class is called, Vaishya class. Of course, his father was a businessman, he was a Vaishya, Gaur Mohan Day. So out of respect to his godbrother, Srila Prabhupada made sure that Madhav Maharaj's chair, his seat, was more elevated than his. So to maintain that etiquette, that, well, he's coming from a Brahmin family, so he's more elevated than me by birth. And it's amazing that Prabhupada would do such a thing in his own temple. He would take that trouble. And Prabhupada just received a full set of the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he wanted Madhav Maharaj to see these books. So we kept showing all the books one by one. And they were all building up in front of him. And he was very impressed that Prabhupada, not only was he translating the Srimad Bhagavatam, but he had also completed the Chaitanya Charitamrita in record time. How many books came out? Was it like a book a month? 17 books in 2 months. That's incredible. I mean, that should be in the Guinness Book of World Records. I mean, I don't know if any other publishing house has ever produced that number of volumes in 2 months. Amazing. So Prabhupada was very proud of that achievement by the Los Angeles BBT. 17 books in 2 months. So Madhav Maharaj was also very impressed with the books. He said, I would like to have a set for my library. And Prabhupada said, yes. And then he said, Dhananjay, he can bring those books to you. So after sitting there for about 15-20 minutes and just talking, just kind of catching up on each other's activities, Madhav Maharaj, you know, makes a move to leave. And so he's going towards the door, and Prabhupada calls me over. He said, if Madhav Maharaj wants these books for his library, he has to first pay for them. He's not getting them free. he made that point. That after all, you know, Prabhupada used so much of his blood. Actually, he used to tell us that. He spent so much of his blood in producing these books for us. So he didn't want to waste his blood unnecessarily by giving away free sets of Chaitanya Charit, even to his own godbrother. I did actually visit the Sri Chaitanya Mat just to do some follow-up. I said, oh, Bhada Maharaj, some time has passed and we were wondering if you're still interested in getting a set of books for your library. He said, oh, yes, yes. And I said, well, the cost will be. And they said, oh, maybe not now, maybe later. But he never actually paid for a set. There was a mother and daughter came to live in the guest house. They were from New Vrindavan. The mother's name was Antarjan, and the daughter's name was Manisha. And she was about 16 years old, and she had been diagnosed as having terminal cancer. And so she was very, very skinny. And basically, the mother had decided that the best place to leave from is Vrindavan for her daughter. So in the beginning, Manisha had enough strength because they were living on the, not the ground floor, but the first floor of the guest house. But she had enough strength to make it on her own for Didi greeting. And Prabhupada noted that she was very, very weak. And so he inquired from the mother, what was the problem? And so the mother explained that we went to a cancer specialist, and he's diagnosed that she only has a few months to live. So Prabhupada actually confirmed that the best place to leave from is Vrindavan. So he said, you should stay here for the rest of, you know, until you leave. After a few weeks, her strength diminished very rapidly, and she stopped coming to Didi greeting. Prabhupada noted that. He said, why is Manisha not coming down to have darshan of Krishna Balaram? And so I told him that actually her mother's told me that she doesn't have the strength anymore. So then Prabhupada told me, he said, so you have to make it your responsibility to carry her from her room down the stairs and bring her into the temple so she can have darshan of the deities. And that's what I did. I would go there every morning to the room and carry her. That's how compassionate Srila Prabhupada was. And later on, because she started to develop symptoms of pneumonia and she wasn't feeling comfortable anymore, she was taken to hospital, in Mathura. And there was always so much fluid building up in her lungs, and she was constantly coughing and bringing up this fluid, and she could hardly sleep. And Antarjan asked the doctor who was in charge of her if he could give her some medicine to relieve this coughing, which he did. But what happened was then, instead of coughing up all this fluid, the fluid started building up in her lungs, and she actually drowned in her own fluids. So she passed away, and this was the first devotee to pass away in Vrindavan. And we didn't know what to do exactly. Of course, when we told Prabhupada that she passed away, he wanted to know the circumstances. And so Antarjan had put on some headphones for her daughter to listen to Prabhupada singing the Guru Vastakam. And so when Prabhupada heard that, he said that because she's been hearing this Guru Vastakam prayer, she's gone back home, back to Godhead. So then I asked, well, what do we do with the body? Because in India, they don't take the body away. The hospital doesn't take care of the body's given to the next of kin. And then the next of kin has to come back with that body to where she's staying. So actually, Manisha's body was lying outside Prabhupada's front door. And so he told me, he said, you should consult the Gaudiya Mutt. They're very expert in how to deal with these circumstances. And he had asked, had Manisha been, was she an unmarried girl or was she a married girl? And she had actually been married quite young in New Vrindavan. So Prabhupada said, because she's been married, then the body should be burnt at the burning ghat. If there's someone who comes to Vrindavan and dies who's unmarried, then the body can be put straight in the Yamuna. That's what he said. So we did consult one of the Gaudiya Mutt temples, and a brahmachari came and he made up a list of all the different ingredients for burning the body. Obviously wood for the fire, and different powders like sandalwood powder and other types of ingredients that are used in disposing of the body. And then also, of course, he instructed us to make a stretcher and put the body on the stretcher and wrap the body in Harinam chadras. And then he said we should go in procession on Harinam Sankirtan down to the burning ghat, which is, you have to go through Loy Bazaar. And none of the shopkeepers there had ever witnessed a Western girl passing away in Vrindavan. And they were very respectful. They came out with all kinds of gifts. And this was in the warm season. And it wasn't the rainy season, it was the hot season, before the rainy season. And then we, after going through Loy Bazaar, headed towards the burning ghat. And just before we arrived at the burning ghat, it started to rain. Lightning. But then it stopped, and then we got down to the side of the Jamuna, and all the wood had been brought there by bullock cart. And so all the preparations were made to burn the body. And so that was done, and then we came back, and Prabhupada wanted to know all, you know, exactly what happened. And so when I told him about that it slightly rained, he said, that's not normal rain. He said, that was the demigods showering flowers on the passing away of a great Vaishnava. So she was very, very fortunate. Although she was very, very young. I mean, 16 is not very old. But still, she was. She made it. You know. She actually. That was the perfection of that human form of life that she had acquired. She went back home, back to Godhead. Did you ever meet that family, Antardhan and Manisha? Srila Prabhupada also introduced the chanting of a particular type of mantra that perhaps you haven't heard before, but this is actually completely bona fide. And Prabhupada went through the names, said you can chant in front of the deities Nitai Gaur, Radhe Shyam, Jaya Krishna, Balaram. Nitai Gaur, Radhe Shyam, Jaya Krishna, Balaram. And he said that this is glorifying the deities on the altars. There's the three altars. There's Nitai Gaur on the left-hand side, Radhe Shyam on the right-hand side, and Krishna Balaram in the middle. Nitai Gaur, Radhe Shyam, Jaya Krishna Balaram. And there is a Nitya-Gaur-Adisham ashram right directly behind the ISKCON guest house. They don't sing that mantra, they sing a Rasabhas mantra, Nitya-Gaur-Adisham, Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. But Prabhupada said that when they hear this, they will think that we're chanting their mantra and they'll become very happy. But it's actually something he said, I want established in our temple, chanting of, you know, glorifying the deities. Like that. Is there any questions or comments so far?
When Prabhupada installed the small building in the altar, were there anything like from other Vaishnava temples?
I don't know, I don't understand your question.
Prabhupada installed his own deity in the altar. Mm-hmm. Did that create any criticism or anything on Prabhupada from other Goswami temples?
No. Because they installed, how could they criticize themselves? All the deities were installed by them. All 10 deities. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, that's 4, Krishna Balaram, that's 6, Radhasham Sundar, Lalita Vishaka, that's another 4, that's 10. All these 10 deities were all installed by the Brijbasi Goswamis and priests. So how could they criticize? Because they made it happen. Although Prabhupada did say, he said, we didn't need such an elaborate arrangement made over 7 days. He said, we could just sit down and chant Hare Krishna, and that would be sufficient. But he said, still we have to go through this procedure so that our temple will be recognized as a bona fide Vrindavan temple. So where is the... there's no room for criticism. They could have said on the spot, no, we don't want to do this, but none of them said that. They all felt honored and they felt, yeah, we want to do this, this is good for our reputation also. They were participating in this Prime Pratishtha. And it was a big public display of their brahminical behavior. It was considered a, you know, very prestigious opportunity for them. You understand what I'm saying? None of them said, oh no, we're not going to go there, we're not going to do this for Swamiji. No, they were all actually very enthusiastic to be included. Even today still, some children of those Brahmins, those priests, they tell us, you know, that, oh yes, my father was there, he did this, he did that. You know, they're very proud. It's something that they'll talk for generations in their family about. It's a very unique occasion. It's a very glorious occasion, a very joyous one. And of course, Dr. Chanda Reddy, he did come. He had this huge security system with so many army people and police people and cars. But he kept his promise. He came on time. And he sat with Srila Prabhupada in his quarters and ate a huge feast. Because it was Ram Navami. Appearance day of Lord Ramachandra, when the deities were finally installed and the temple was officially opened. Then there was a huge photo taken. I don't know who took that photo with all the devotees standing with Prabhupada at the front of the front entrance of the temple. That was some a few days after that. But you then took the photo of Prabhupada offering the first arti. And that was not easy to do, was it? That was quite a difficult endeavor, wasn't it?
Yeah,
So that famous picture of Prabhupada fanning with the peacock fan, right? Did you take any other photos besides that? And where are those photos? Are they
in the archives?
They're in the archives. Is there any particular moment that you remember about that installation? Or that first arti that Prabhupada offered?
Well, that installation at one point in the ceremony, Prabhupada was requested to come out. So he sat there, it's actually in the beginning, he's sitting there. He's completely expressionless. I've never seen him in a photograph before. And his body was there, but it was clear that he was somewhere else. Because it really wasn't, he was, as you said, he made that arrangement so that the Vrijvasis would accept it. Temples would accept it. Temples would accept it. Temples would accept it. Temples would accept it. That was the actual installation. His disciples chanted. So he was there physically, but he was.
Did you ever ask him afterwards what he was thinking at that moment? Did you also take some photos of Dr. Chanda Reddy with Srila Prabhupada?
I walked. This car inside.
There was a lot of security, wasn't there? There was a lot of, there's a big army of people.
They tried to give him a garland.
Do you remember the feast? It was a full-on grand feast, wasn't it, in the evening? Did you take photos of, for instance, like the Didi kitchen or any other parts of the temple? There's what, at least 400 devotees there. Is that right? That's not an exaggeration.
Oh, we can take that group picture. Yeah.
Did you go on any of those morning walks straight after? Is there any kind of memorable things the Prophet said, if you can remember?
One morning he came out of the temple and he looked at the ruins of those doors and trees. He was astonished. But he said that actually we should be able to look at the ruins. How many times this one? How much of the ruins?
Yeah, tomorrow's the Kadashi. As it so happens. So we can look at the moon tonight and see. Then we can say, oh, tomorrow's the Kadashi.
And then he was walking and he said that inside the moon there's ice. The moon is surrounded by ice and inside the ice there's a fire. And that fire coming through the ice makes the rays of the moon cool. It's like amazing.
He said that?
Yeah. The fire inside surrounded by ice and then therefore because of the ice and the rays of the moon cool. So that was one of the few times that I actually asked him a question. So I asked him, I said, if I were a kid, it says that the rays from the moon and the vegetables succulent. So how was that? Well, the dinner was on the top. He stopped walking. He looked right at me. And I said, why don't you ask him?
That's really interesting because I was on that walk when Prabhupada was speaking to Srup Damodar about the nature of the moon. Because he wanted Srup Damodar to use this information to defeat the scientists' claim that man is going to the moon. He said the moon is twice as far from the earth, and if they ever went to the moon, then they have to, first of all, pass by the sun. They have to, you know, travel beyond the sun. And then he said about the fact that the moon is self-effulgent, but it's giving off cooling rays. And on that morning, because Prabhupada was obviously translating the fifth canto at that time, and I said, is it like, for instance, a candle behind a block of ice, that you can see the light, but there's no heat? I asked that question. And he looked at me, because he didn't like that sort of, kind of like thinking. And it's interesting what you just said about that there is this ice around the moon, and this fire behind the ice. So really, that's pretty much the same thing. Because he didn't reply. He didn't reply to that question I asked him. So it must have been around the same time. Because he was very much absorbed in talking, discussing about the moon with Surat Damodar, who was a brahmachari, of course, at that time. Another day, Prabhupada called me in and said to me, I want you to go to Manipur. And I already had so many things on my plate, now he wants me to go to Manipur. And Manipur, if you don't know, is very far from Vrindavan. It's about 1,500 kilometers away in the far northeast. It's the easternmost part of India, in fact. The sun rises like 3 o'clock in the morning or 3:30 in the morning there. It's the first place where the sun rises. You know, it's even beyond Bangladesh. It's bordering what's now known as Myanmar. At that time is Burma. So my first reaction was, why? why do you want me to go to Manipur? And so then he always had a good reason to say anything, of course. So he said, during the British rule, so many Scottish missionaries went to Manipur and converted the local Manipuri Vaishnavas into Christians. Then he pointed at me and said, you are a Scottish Vaishnav. So now you have to go there and convert all those Manipuri Christians back into being Vaishnavas. And he actually also informed Surat Damodar that he should give me all assistance in making sure that I got the proper entry permit, because at that time Manipur was off limits. It was a restricted area. Remember when you used to get the stamp when you came into the country? And this, it says this visa's allowed for certain areas but not restricted areas. And one of those areas was, of course, Manipur. And we even went to see a Manipuri MP in Delhi, and Tombi Singh. Because, you know, Manipur was actually a Vaishnava country. It's a place where Arjuna visited, and he married a local princess called Chitrangada. And they had a son called Babruvahan. And Prabhupada says in the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in one of the purports, that all the present-day residents of Manipur are all descended from Arjuna and Chitrangada. So they're all Kshatriyas. Most of their last name is Singh. Singh meaning Kshatriya. And in the 18th century, a disciple of Narottam Das Thakur was instructed by Narottam Das Thakur to visit Manipur and convert the local king, Maharaj Bhagya Chandra, from being an animist into a Vaishnava. And so he was very successful in doing that. He went there, met with the king, Maharaj Bhagya Chandra, convinced him that his whole kingdom should take on, you know, the Vaishnava tradition. And so the king instructed that deities should be made out of jackfruit wood. So in the, when you go to the capital of Manipur, which is known as Imphal, there's the Radha Govinda Mandir, and there's three altars, and it looks like an ISKCON temple. Or, you know, you have Jagannath Subhadra Baladev, you have Radha Govinda, and you have Krishna Balaram, deities. And all their songs and all their tradition is all based on the songs of Narottam Das Thakur, but translated into the Manipuri language. And they have a whole Vaishnav culture, the way they pay obeisances to each other, the way they have their Sankirtan parties, they have ladies' parties as well as men's parties. It's much more of a matriarchal kind of society where the ladies predominate the men. And but they have hundreds and hundreds of these Sankirtan groups that they form. And they all have, their local mridanga is called a pung. And then they have their own type of kartals, and they have a special way of blowing two conch shells at once. It's quite amazing. But it took me 16 years to get the entry permit. And when I got the entry permit, that was, I applied in 75, but I didn't get any response until 1991. And then they gave me 5 days. Not much you can do in 5 days. But it's quite an extraordinary place. And even all the local Brahmin families, they have in their courtyards of their homes, they have a special, it looks like what we would call in the West a bandstand. It's a round circular raised platform with steps going up with a railing around it and a little tin roof. It looks like a bandstand, but it's the place we're doing kirtan. And it's always directly across from the altar. And their deities are either Krishna Balaram or Radha Krishna or Gornitai. And it's their tradition. And they always pay full dandavats to each other when they meet, when the different Sankirtan parties meet. And there's a beautiful temple there too. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Mani Mandir. And they have three altars with Shri Shri Radha Krishna, Gornitai, and Jagannath. And they also have another altar with a big Lord Shringadev. And it's absolutely gorgeous. If you ever get the opportunity to take photos of that temple, it's not many devotees. Well, of course, I think they have did you ever look on their website? It's gone Manipur. It's an extraordinary achievement. This is a huge temple. It's not a small little rinky-dink thing. It's, you know, and it's raised also. You have to climb up lots of stairs to get into the main kirtan hall. It's an extraordinary thing because it's a very, very poor state. But, you know, Prabhupada wanted that. He actually wanted to visit Manipur too, but unfortunately got too sick. And he had to cancel his trip there. Any other questions? Said, sometimes it appears that a spiritual master can say contradictory things to others, the opposite of what he said to someone else. But, you know, he wasn't in any way being frivolous about this chanting of Nitai Gaurani Sham Jai Krishna Bhavan. Because how many temples do we have with those deities on the altar? There's not many temples with three altars. Of course, here you have three altars. Gauranitai, Radha Gopinath, and Jagannath. But it served a purpose also, because behind, as I mentioned, the Iskcon guest house, there is an Nitai Gaurani Sham. And in fact, there's a few in that area. It's not just one, there's several Nitai Gaurani Sham ashrams in Ramanreti. They've been chanting for a long, long time. Before there was a before the Krishna Balan temple was built. Long before that time. But what they chant is not bona fide. It's not recommended. But Prabhupada did recommend that we sing in our Krishna Balaram temple, Nitai Gaur Radhe Shyam Jaya Krishna Balaram. What other temples?
Like here, for example, chanting these names.
Yes.
It's fine.
Yes. When we sing Jai Radha Gopinath, you mean? And Jai Jagannath and Gaurinitai. Well, yeah, we're supposed to be meditating on the deities. There's nothing wrong with that.
Sorry. I was wondering if it's okay to chant, like, let's say here, if we chant the names of the deities in the Vrindavan, is that okay? We just chant the deities in that, give it a temple.
I don't see any difficulty in chanting names of other deities in other temples. There's nothing wrong in that. But he's entitled to his opinion also.
Yeah, he quotes from other locations. Well, one of the instances was they were chanting too much Hari Bol or something. Prabhupada after they commented, they might chant Hari Bol, Hari Bol, I will chant Hare Krishna, Bol, Krishna, something. That's what.
But there's no contradiction, actually. I did have a conversation with Jai Dwaita Swami about this particular instruction that was given to me, and he thought that Prabhupada was just joking. I said, no, he wasn't joking. And I said, were you there when he said that to me? He said, no, I wasn't. I said, so how do you know he was joking? There's still a chance during kirtan. I suppose also you can say that Srila Prabhupada is, you know, he has a personal relationship with all of us. So he says something to Jai Dwaita Swami, he might not say to me, or he might not say to Vishakha. But that's because he's dealing with this in a personal, one-to-one basis. Sometimes it's nectarian, sometimes it's chastisement, sometimes it's perhaps a general instruction. So you have to see. You have to see how the spiritual master deals with all of his followers individually. Which I'm going to save for this afternoon. That's the some things I'm not saying now. But, you know, we can finish on certain things that perhaps Prabhupada never thought about as a rule. But, because naturally when you know somebody over a certain number of years, then you have a pretty good idea of what that devotee's like and what their needs are, what they're lacking in. You know what I mean? It's natural. That's being personal. So he might say something to me that he might not say to Jai Dwaita Swami. In fact, there's lots of things he'll say to me that he definitely won't say to Jai Dwaita Swami. And also, he might say lots of things to Jai Dwaita Swami that he definitely wouldn't say to me, because Jai Dwaita Swami's role was an editor. He was a brahmachari, and he was an editor. So, you know, there was certain things that he would say to him, and I'm a householder with family, and he would say things to me that he definitely wouldn't bring up with Jai Dwaita, because he's a brahmachari. You understand the point I'm trying to make? That, you know, it's not rubber stamping. It's not that Prabhupada had the same conversation with every one of us. He had unique conversations with all of us. And that uniqueness will always be there in every circumstance, because we're all unique individuals. So naturally, a brahmachari's needs are not the same as who was I saying that to? But actually, Prabhupada did say that the temple, you know, compound is a place which is meant for brahmacharis and sannyasis, and householders are meant to live outside. That's what he said to me. But I'm not going to go beyond saying that, because there's lots of other things that he said besides that. But this is what he was talking about, specifically about Vrindavan. He said the temple compound is meant for brahmacharis and sannyasis, and householders are meant to live outside. And I can elaborate on that this afternoon. And he wouldn't have that conversation with Jai Dwaita, because he's a brahmachari. It's got nothing to do with him. Probably talk about editing problems or translating this and that and whatever. Just like with Rameshwar, we saw there's lots of films where Rameshwar is meeting with Srila Prabhupada in his quarters in Los Angeles. And what is he talking about? Sending money to India for the BBT or for construction work. Why was that? Because Rameshwar was a BBT trustee, and he was living in one of the most successful book distribution temples in North America. And it was literally hundreds of thousands of dollars coming in from, devotees like Tripurari and Gopavrindapal and, you know, so many other big, you know, stalwart book distributors. So it sounds like business. You know, what is this? What's Prabhupada got to do with all this money moving around? But we know. We need, you know, that money was required. And Prabhupada always had this concept that the money from the BBT would go to construction, you know, temple construction. Right? What was the percentage? Yeah, 50%. So he wouldn't have that conversation with a cook. What's the cook got to do with moving huge amounts of money around, building temples and publishing? You know, a cook is a cook. So probably talk recipes with a cook. You see? But still we can learn. You know, that's, I suppose, why we have these retreats. So we get, you know, as much of a detailed picture of how Prabhupada not only managed, but of course he also how he reciprocated with his disciples. So that really, you know, I can say fleshes out the persona of Srila Prabhupada. Does that make sense? Yeah. So now we can have one quick question. Yes, unfortunately, there's so many Christian missionaries. They've inundated that state. Yes. Unfortunately. Well, they bribe. They say, you become a Christian, then we'll give you money for your education. We'll make sure you get a good job. Because there's not many... Yeah, there's not many job opportunities available.
And,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's through bribing. Basically.
In South India.
In South India, they're canvassing for Muslims. They're trying to convert people to become Muslims. They do the same thing there. You become Muslim, then we can give you... Because, you know, there's so many Muslim countries that are very well off, like Saudi Arabia, for example. So that converting is going on. But, you know, we're talking about faith. You know, Prabhupada said Christianity, Judaism, Islam, they're faith. You can change your faith. But what we're practicing is Sanatana Dharma. This is not to do with faith. This is to do with the occupational duty of the living entity, the eternal occupational duty. But for economic means, you know, many of these Manipuris turn to, you know, to Christianity. Secretly?
Yeah.
Well, they're very clannish, I have to say. They're tribal people. There's the Maitais, that's one tribe. There's the Nagas, that's another tribe. And there's the Kukis, they're also a tribe. And there's lots of other subdivisions of tribes too. And they all kind of identify with a certain type of cloth and a certain color that they wear. Almost like, you know, in Scotland when the clans had their tartans, they wear, they could tell he's a Stuart or MacDonald or MacTavish or whatever. So also there, you can identify the tribes by their traditional cloth that they put on. Again, normally they don't wear that, they just wear Western clothes, and the ladies wear these, they look like pink sannyas dhotis. But they're very much into their tribal roots. And tribespeople are fair game for Christianity. I don't know why, but up there in Nagaland and Arunachal Pradesh and Mizoram and all these other states that you probably never heard of before, but which are all part of India, they're mostly, they're predominantly Christian. Meghalaya, have you heard of those places? No. That's because none of us can really get there. It's not that easy to go there for Westerners. It's like a small forgotten pocket of India up there in the northeast. But the Manipuri tradition is, you know, it was based on Vaishnava Dharma. But that's been eroded, unfortunately, due to the influence of Kali Yuga. And Prabhupada wanted that revived. That's why he was enthusiastic about sending, especially Scottish Vaishnavas, to go there. Well, we don't get too much time because it's a restricted area. I mean, now you can stay for up to 1 month if you're lucky, but you have to pay a lot of money. And it's part of India. That's a weird thing. It's not like you're going to a different country. It's the same country, but it's like off limits. But if you pay a certain price and get the, you know, the entry permit, It's just
even for Indians.
Well, Indians, they have to get an inner line pass. For foreigners, it's called an entry permit. I was the sixth Westerner to visit in 1991, and before me were five Japanese families, because a lot of Japanese war graves are to be found in that part of India. That's another whole historical lesson. Nothing to do with Krishna consciousness. So we'll finish there. Thank you very much. Then we'll have our final session this afternoon at 3:30. Hare Krishna. All glories to Shri Prabhupada.